Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Howie Kasser James Show. Talk radio for fine minds. And now your host for the hour, Howie Kasser James.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to the Howie Kasser James Show. I am your host, Hallie Kasser-Jane. The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show is brought to you today by Hemisphere Development. Hemisphere Development delivers socially responsible, sustainable solutions for large-scale, environmentally troubled properties. For more information, visit Hemisphere on its website at www.hemispheredev.com. So here we are, another Wednesday, 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Really am glad to have you here with me. Today on the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, controversial psychotherapist, Manhattan's most media-friendly therapist, according to the New York Observer, Jonathan Appa's Bible Psychology Today. Long-term therapy versus short-term therapy has long been a subject of debate in the mental health field and a taboo. Proving the man knows of what he speaks, the very fearless Alpert broke the taboo. But before we talk to Jonathan Alpert, let me tell you a little more about him. In case you missed it, Jonathan is known for delivering frank yet helpful advice. He's frequently called on to comment on hard news stories, current events, lifestyle and hot-button issues, celebrities, mental health, politicians' foibles, and more. Jonathan has appeared on every major news show and is frequently quoted in the press. His column, No More Drama, runs biweekly in the Metro newspaper and reaches 1 million readers in New York, Boston, and Philadelphia. He also writes a column for the celebrity website X17 called Hollywood Breakdown. Jonathan holds an advanced degree in psychology. He began his career in emergency care, later worked in academia, did a stint at the FBI where apparently he himself learned to be fearless, and currently has a thriving practice in New York. So, Jonathan Alpert, welcome to the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. How does that make you feel, Mr. Chutzpah?
Thank you for having me on. What an introduction.
Glad to have you here.
I'm controversial now.
I think so. What do you think?
Well, you know, I think it needed to be there. I think the mental health community needed to be stirred because, frankly, way too many people, it feels good to vent, and the therapist listens. It feels good to be listened to. But there's a big difference between feeling good and actually getting better, and that's what, in my book, Be Fearless, I talk about. Be Fearless gives you a solid, practical plan to actually get past things that are holding you back. So whatever the fear might be, if it's something that gets between you and achieving a personal goal, such as running a marathon or starting a business or going back to school, the 5 steps doesn't get you better. So you're building like this pseudo relationship, and it just fosters a very unhealthy environment. So the therapist might be harming you.
Harming is a huge word. That is a huge word. Feeding the problem rather than taking action on the problem, which, again, we're going to talk about later. Has therapy turned into a business rather than a devotion?
Therapy is a business, and it's how thousands of people earn a living, myself included. And I was raised that you do your best, you give it your best, you do a good job, and if you're really good at what you do, then you'll be successful. You know, people will tell their friends, and word of mouth will help to build your business. And it's worked for me. Unfortunately, though, not everyone follows that. But it is a business. And what happens is a lot of business people try to keep people in therapy so that they can keep the business and keep the money coming in. And that's doing a disservice to the client.
Medicine, you know, like when you're a doctor, you have the oath, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's always been this weird delineation between the brain and the body. And we all know that what goes on in the brain is medical too, right, to a great degree.
I was going to say there's an undeniably strong link between the body and the mind.
And so what I'm saying here is that
the two blades of green grass are the same shade. So it's hard to standardize treatment, therefore it's hard to measure success. And, you know, it's not like a depressed person comes in and this is what you do, and you do that for the next person, the next person, and the next person. So as a result, there isn't a lot of policing or evaluating of practices. So it's not quite the same as medicine, where if you have a strep throat, there's a certain medication that you take or a certain course of treatment, a certain protocol. So this is much different.
In that sense, that today's therapy practice can keep people miserable, and so be it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is in a way what you were talking about in that article that I thought was so brilliant. Because you're saying that they have to be more than sounding boards, then how does that make you feel?
Oh, that hurts my ears.
That your public disavowal of long-term therapy might send some long-term frustrated patients, like the way the woman I was telling you about, into panic? I read somewhere where a guy was absolutely flipped after years of therapy and having to question everything he'd been doing all those years.
Yeah. Well, I think part of what's happening with that article is people are feeling as though they need to defend what they've been doing for 10, 12, 20 years going to therapy. And by no means did I want to offend people. If it's working, if they're getting better, then good for them. But for a majority of the people, they're stuck in therapy and they're mired in therapy. And I know this because I've received countless emails from people saying how refreshed it was to read the article, and they're changing course. They're going to change providers and find someone who's more short-term oriented. Certainly couldn't approach them or ask them on a date, and never went to any school dances or proms or any of the normal things that kids do. But then I started to get much more comfortable with who I was, and sort of embraced my geekiness and my dorkiness and became comfortable with it, and was totally fine with it, and realized that some things can change, other things can't change, and I'll focus on the things that I can actually change. And have always felt like I have had a pretty good impact on people when I do talk to them, and wanted to have my own business and wanted it to involve people. So really got serious about that when I was in my junior year of undergraduate studies and just took all sorts of psychology classes and got involved with volunteer work. I worked at a suicide crisis hotline and just found it absolutely fascinating, and then aggressively pursued grad work and really being able to understand the fearful mind and also the fearless mind. And what you have in the book is a description of what a fearful mind is, what a fearless mind is, and then the action plan, the 5 steps on how to be fearless. So it really does come from my practice, and I also include some case studies, some significant patients that I've worked with over the years who really exemplify the essence of fearlessness. And there's some fascinating stories in the book that will resonate with readers. years ago when we needed to be prepared. So we would think ahead, we would create different scenarios so that we would be able to respond appropriately. We don't quite need that today, but it has stayed with many people, and it just gets us in a very, very negative place, and it can wreak havoc on our mind, on our body, and our ability to pursue certain goals. So fear is really about uncertainty, and that's what
drives anxiety. But it's also a good thing, too, though, isn't it?
Fear can, in the book, I tell a story about when I was on TV. I was on the Nancy Grace show, and she's quite confrontational. That's her style. And I was extremely nervous and anxious to the point where I felt like my heart was pounding out of my chest. And we had a little break, a commercial break, and I talked to myself. I said, Jonathan, this is good. Your heart's pounding. You're getting blood to your system. You're going to be alert. You're going to be sharp. And I really tried to change the way that I thought about that anxiety and that fear, and it actually helped. I was able to come up with some strong statements when we came out of the commercial break.
But now I want to fine-tune that a little bit, because there's fear, there's anxiety, there's excitement, and really it's kind of difficult to delineate sometimes between the three of them. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, the difference is usually in the mind and how we interpret these sensations.
So how do we get to some people being so just taking it all as fear and a fear that can completely overwhelm them to some people, I being one of them, that when I get afraid, I find it exciting and I go to it?
You're fearless, that's why.
Well, I'm not fearless. I feel the fear.
You feel it, but you don't let it keep
right.
You stuck.
Now, what's the difference between people who don't do that and people like me?
Well, someone who doesn't do that, they get stuck in the negativity, and they're not able to see past it. And, you know, it impacts everything, how they talk to themselves, the narrative that they might play in their head, I'm no good, I can't, I shouldn't, I won't pursue something. Whereas with you, you acknowledge it, this is scary, I'm a little uncomfortable, but I'm going to go for it anyhow. And that's the difference between someone who's fearless and fearful.
Is that taught behavior?
I'm sorry?
Is that a learned behavior?
Can be created. For example, if a mother panics every time she sees a spider, and her child sees that, then the child then might start to become fearful around spiders. The same might be true for heights or elevators or any of these classic phobias. So certainly fear and anxiety can be learned.
And that's probably how we are all formed, right, by what we see around us.
Yeah, well, we are greatly influenced by our environment.
Okay. I mean, because... People are so together in some aspects of their life, and they're just paralyzed with fear in others. Is it because of that, because they see one aspect of maybe a parent giving them something or teaching them something, and it doesn't, and the other side, they learn something different?
Different parts of their functioning. Someone might be incredibly successful in their career and incredibly competent at giving speeches in front of large groups, but they might be terrible at having one-on-one conversations with their, not quite my thing. This is a little embarrassing, but I'm afraid of dogs, or I'm uncomfortable around dogs.
Seriously?
Right, and as a kid, I was probably 5 or 6, and this is actually in my book, I was chased by a little poodle. And, I was walking with my dad, and I went around the corner being a rambunctious little kid, and then I was running back as fast as I could with this little poodle chasing me. So to this...
Dancing with the Stars.
That's right.
There you go.
Plenty of places.
Let's get serious for a second, because you do bring something up that I think is just so important, and that is you talk about pharmacology and its use today in the mental health field, or, and I should say, even overuse. Let's talk about that. Next week, as a matter of fact, you'll be interested to know, I've got a guy named Dr. Joe Troncalli on and a bunch of people who are doing something different now with drug and alcohol abuse. That's a completely new thing you might want to listen to. That's just thought I'd throw that in, guys, if you're listening. Joe Troncalli is a great guy, and you're going to love listening to him next week. But pharmacology, I mean, this is what in the world?
I can certainly speak to what I'm seeing as a therapist. I'm not a medical doctor, I have to make that clear, but I can certainly speak to what I'm seeing as a therapist. And over the past several years, I'm just seeing a tendency for people to want medication sooner than they have in the past. And doctors are much quicker to give medication. And it speaks to the culture that we live in, where it's sort of a pill-popping culture. Pop a pill, get a harder erection. Pop a pill, focus better, do better on your test. So why not pop a pill and feel better? And one of the things that I always tell clients is medication will not provide insight into why you're doing what you're doing, and they get chronic headaches. So there are some side effects from medications that in some cases might be worse than the original problem. I'm not against medication. I do think there are certainly cases where people need it, but I do think people should be really good consumers when it comes to medication. And if they are taking medication that for a psychological issue, they should definitely do therapy as well as an adjunct.
Is there another side to it, which is if you take the medication and you're committed to taking it for life, that it masks the symptoms enough that you can go on to function, like, who cares then? Is that the theory behind this, give everybody a pill?
You know, I have heard that from a lot of clients, where they say they care less about things that they once cared a whole lot about. So they're somewhat numb, and most people don't want to go through life feeling numb. And, you know, I try to explain to people that it's okay to feel anger and sadness, and certainly okay to feel grief, people.
Well, yeah, but that's not what you hear. You hear so often, don't be angry, don't be sad, don't cry, don't do this, as if the normal human feeling realm is somehow, not nice or not good or bad. You're a bad little girl. Don't you think that is a part of society?
We're being held to a unrealistic standard. Since when is it not healthy to show emotion?
Well, boys are taught, I don't know if they still are, but certainly in my early days, they were told not to show emotion, yeah?
Right, and part of it is we're socialized in such a way where boys are supposed to be tough and strong, and it's okay for girls to not be so strong and show more of emotion.
Yeah, I think all of this plays into what we're going to talk about in the second half hour when we really get into the depths of this book. And we are now, folks, we're just at that half hour, and I have been making Jonathan crazy, I think, so I'm going to give him a rest.
You're not making me crazy.
I make men crazy all the time. And it's time for our break. So when we come back, we'll be talking to Jonathan Alper about his book and his program, Be Fearless, Change Your Life in 28 Days. So Jonathan and everyone tuned in, sit back, relax a minute while we recognize our sponsors. You are listening to The Hallie Castor Jane Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. The Hallie Castor Jane Show is brought to you today by 4TEL Solutions.
Election upon us, you'll want your copy of Hallie Castor Jane's book, A Year in My Pajamas with President Obama, The Politics of Strange Bedfellows. Howie's take on the American political scene is like nothing you've ever read. Smart, brassy, and thought-provoking. Howie's view is that of an independent thinker with an uncommon sense of humor and a nose for the truth. Purchase your copy of A Year in My Pajamas with President Obama, the Kindle version at Amazon.com, books at Barnes & Noble stores, and fine booksellers everywhere. And by the way, don't forget to follow Howie and all of her musings on Facebook at www.facebook.com/HallieCasserJane, on Twitter at HallieCJ, and at HallieCasserJane.com.
We're back on the Hallie Casser Jane Show, where today we're talking with controversial therapist and the author of the brand new book, Be Fearless, Change Your Life in 28 Days, Jonathan Alpert. Jonathan, did you have a moment to breathe?
I did. I'm all set to go.
Here we go. So let's just, in case we have people joining us at the half hour, let's just go back again for a brief definition of fear.
Fear is a four-letter word that begins with F, and it's about the unknown. It's about uncertainty, and fear is what gets between us in achieving success and certain goals and dreams. And it's how the mind sort of tries to create predictability to achieve some sort of control over a situation. Fear is something we want to get past and over and deal with so that it will actually motivate us and drive us forward, and that's what we find in the book.
So the difference between fearless people and fearful people?
Fearful people get caught up on fear. They see it as an obstacle, and they think of reasons why they can't or shouldn't or won't do something, and they're essentially held hostage by fear. Whereas fearless people see possibilities and opportunities past that initial emotion that they might feel, that fear. It's not debilitating. It's not holding them back.
The opposite of fearful, is it fearless or courageous?
I would say it's both. I think one needs to be courageous to be fearless.
That's a good answer. Action versus control, is that the difference between the two?
Yes. Taking action can really move someone out of a place of feeling stagnant and stuck. And that's why a therapy that's really outcome-oriented and where someone has homework and different tasks can be quite effective, so similar to what's in Be Fearless.
Should we be talking about control, because control is such an issue for a lot of people, self-control. Doesn't that get in the way of their taking risks and chances or being fearless?
It does. I mean, there are people like to have control over a situation, and if we can't predict outcomes or what might happen next, then we feel like we have no control, and frankly that renders a lot of people helpless and stuck. But there's always something to have control over. I see people who are unemployed and they feel like they have no control over their future. They have no idea what tomorrow might bring. So I get them to start to think about things that they do have control over. So that might be something as simple as what time they get up in the morning, what time they go to sleep the night before, how they conduct their job search, what they do for a job search, when they do it, and start to build control back into their life, and they start to feel much better.
So control is a good thing and control is a bad thing.
Too much control, or the need to have too much control, can be a bad thing, and that's bordering more on like a compulsion. No one likes a control freak.
And there are so many of us out there. It's a problem. The fearful actually do experience fear differently than the fearless, right? I'm going to go back over that a little bit and explore that a little bit more, because I think that's huge.
Yes. Yeah, the fearless feel it, but they're not stuck there. They might feel some of the same sensation, the same physical sensations that the fearful feel, such as the increased heart rate and the breathing increases, and they might actually get sweaty palms, but they deal with it differently. They actually see it as a good thing, and they're able to recognize that their body is responding in a way that's healthy and helpful, and that they can rely on their body. They know that their body is responding in a way where if they need to run fast or if they need to be super sharp, they'll be with situations, even if they're not the best situations. They get comfortable being uncomfortable. And I see this all the time in relationships. People stay in a bad marriage, and they stay because their thinking is, well, he's a jerk, but I don't feel like going out into the world and having to deal with new jerks or the potential for dealing with new jerks. So they get comfortable being uncomfortable, and they're afraid to face what the unknown, what's out there. I see it in Korea.
If you made a decision to do something different in your life, be it change your career, change your marriage, change your whatever, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I worked with someone recently who was fearful of going to the doctor. She was a perfectly healthy person, but she was just fearful of going for her annual exam. And she actually made herself sick by getting so nervous for the appointment. And then she went, and after she said,
it seems bizarre that, there's some animal, a moth goes to a flame. That's like the humans aren't any different.
the natural tendency is to avoid pain and discomfort. So naturally, we wouldn't want to go to the thing that we fear, the dance floor for me, or with this patient going to her medical doctor. So naturally we avoid that, but by doing so, we only strengthen that. So the more I avoiding it doesn't make it go away, but facing it does.
But you go even further with than that. You say that if that unknown thing we turn into a negative most of the time because we're conditioned to turn that which we don't know into a negative, right? I'm paraphrasing, but you could probably explain that better.
Right. We're primed to think negatively, and this goes back thousands of years ago when we needed to be alert to danger. You know, there were wild animals out lurking out there, and they could kill us. So we needed to be hypervigilant and super alert to danger. And in my book, I tell a story about, or I ask readers to think about if you're on the street and on one street corner you see a gentleman helping an old lady cross the street, and then on the other corner you see a man mugging an old lady. Which one do you remember? Which one do you go home and tell your family about?
The negative.
Of course. And that's because we're more primed to remember negativity, and that's called the negativity bias. We remember bad fights and bad accidents more so than we remember pleasant moments in our life.
And can that be switched? We can reprime ourselves to that?
Yes,
against
that? That can be switched, but it's also helpful to know that when we need it, it's there. When we need to be super alert and vigilant, we're able to. But we can turn that down a bit.
Turn it down. You don't want to turn it off. You're saying you want to turn it down to have
it
available.
No, it can actually weaken our stomach, and we have different aches and pains. It's just the way our body responds. Our muscles might get tense and stiff, and that leads to a headache or neck ache or back ache. It's just a super strong connection between the mind and the body.
There is, and I'd love to have another show with you and to talk about that, because it seems so bizarre to me that there's just not enough focus on that in regular, everyday, colloquial talk around medicine. You know, people still push that connection away, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still the stigma with exploring the mind, I think. Change takes action, right?
Sure does.
But action isn't easy.
It sure
is. For a lot of people. So let's talk about taking action.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, no action isn't easy, and no one's asking anyone to, you know, do anything crazy. You know, if you look at a firefighter, they didn't just run into a burning house their first day on the job. They went through extensive training to learn how to do that. You don't go out and run a marathon your first day of running. You run a mile, and then you add to it and build up to that distance. So you're not going to face the thing that you fear most in life just by throwing yourself into it. You're going to work on it in a very systematic way and, you know, over time develop the confidence and competence to tackle the fear. And that's what the book really lays out for people. That program mean? Does that mean just saying I'll join the gym, or does that mean I'm going to go to the local health club on such and such a street, inquire about membership, and actually bring my shorts and sneakers and be prepared to work out? People need to be very specific when they define their goal, because when it's a vague generalization, it's easier to walk away from. But when it's something specific, it's harder to walk away from it. And when it's specific, then we can come up with a practical and realistic plan gain by focusing on the goal.
Some people are so much, it comes easy, change, when they make that commitment, they're able to do it so much quicker than others. I mean, is there a reason? Is there something that we know that's a reason?
But those people probably didn't just wake up one day and say, today's the day. There was probably something that led up to it.
Okay.
You know, it's like when you can't get the cap off of a jar and it grows much bigger and becomes a problem in itself.
So let's talk about that stinking thinking. You know, AA talks about stinking thinking, I think. I've heard that. A lot of what's going on the fearful is stinking thinking, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of it is. It's negative thinking. We all have a narrative, and fearless people have a narrative that's empowering and motivating, whereas fearful people have one that's quite negative, and they might think things, oh, I can never do this because of X, Y, and Z, or that girl will never like me because I'm fat or I'm short or I'm ugly or she'll think I'm stupid. So really working to change the narrative can have a huge impact on how someone changes. I tell my clients, you know, Michael Jordan, every time he got the ball, he thought, oh my, I'll never make this basket. He probably wouldn't have done so well in his career, but he didn't think that way. He probably was confident and had a very positive and empowering narrative, and that's in part why he was successful. One of the people who endorsed my book is Dan Jansen. He won Olympic gold in speed skating. And he's a fearless guy. He fell down, but he got back up, and he ended up winning the event. And my guess is that he had a very positive, empowering narrative, as opposed to something that was negative.
And you feel that you can actually take whatever that.
And people are too focused on why they can't do something. And then when I get talking to them and I ask them to think differently or consider alternative ways of thinking, then, you know, slowly they're able to come around and look at things much differently.
Okay, so you say to your readers, and we're getting to the nuts and bolts of all this thing, that you can quickly transform their lives under your 5-step program. So let's briefly go over the 5 steps.
Sure. So I write down all the reasons why they think they can't do something, and that's what I call a fear dump. And it's a good way to really purge the system of the negativity and really reframe the negative thinking and get past some of the obstacles. And then the next step, step 3, is rewriting the inner narrative. So that's what we just talked about, where I have people recognize some of their thinking traps and some of the thinking that historically has been holding them back. And there are various exercises for people to change that thinking. And then the 4th step is eliminating the fear response. And this really gets into some of the physiological responses to fear. that we experience. So I go through some exercises, some relaxation exercises, as well as visualization that helps to calm down the mind and the body. And studies have actually shown that some of these exercises can lower blood pressure. So they're quite healthy, and they're a great way to deal with stress as well. And then step five is live your dream, and that's where people craft their fearless action plan and really put what they've learned in the previous four steps into action and pursue their dream and their goal.
I think it's fascinating.
That's a very abbreviated version of five steps.
Yeah. I think it's a good thing to do that, because I think those who are listening to it, who are looking to make a change, you know, we're giving them, or you're giving them, just a brief synopsis of what they will explore when they pick up your book, Change Your Life, Be Fearless, Change Your Life in 28 Days. The fearful people worry too much about what other people think.
They do. Fearful people might be people pleasers. They might be thinking of what others think or trying to meet other people's standards and satisfy the needs of others before their own. And that can really dictate their behavior and how they are in life. And that's not the healthiest approach.
No, it certainly is not. And I want to add this self-help movement that's been going for some years now, you know, and you go to the local bookstore and you can buy a book. And don't misunderstand me, I'm not in any way denigrating it, because I've bought a lot of those books in my time. But what I want to ask you is honestly, can it be dangerous? I mean, I think that's a fair question, to lead people to, guys, your dreams can come true. And I really think he chunks it down enough so that you could actually break some of the bad cycles. Are people more fearful today? Or just more honest about how fearful
there is a lot to be fearful of. We're in tough times. The economy is not very good, and we're a decade off of, or 12 years off of 9/11, and there are things to be fearful of today that we didn't have to deal with 20 years ago. And there's technology and all sorts of other things that come into play that can cause stress in our lives. So there's a lot of stress out there. There's a lot of fear, but I'm sure every generation and every decade has their unique stressors and fears.
Are we crazier today?
I think every generation is crazy today. there's help out there, and there's hope out there, and become the new norm. But it does impact people. In a big way.
No doubt about it. But there does seem to be one good thing, and I think it's a good thing, and that is people are more honest about how they feel today. Don't you think so?
I think people have become somewhat desensitized, and the stigmas aren't as great, so we are able to express ourselves and be okay with it. And I think we have politicians and celebrities who are coming out with various health issues and mental health issues, and it makes it a little easier for the rest of us to do so as well.
So one last question, Jonathan. Is fearlessness attainable for all?
Absolutely. People can absolutely become fearless and achieve their dreams and goals.
The author, the fearless Jonathan Albert. The book, Be Fearless, Change Your Life in 28 Days. If you are tired of being stuck, Day is available at all fine bookstores. Before we go, I want to give you a heads up. June 4th, 2/12, we'll mark the first annual National Girlfriends Networking Day, a day devoted to helping young women so vastly underrepresented in leadership roles to advance and succeed. This extraordinary mentoring effort is spearheaded by the Hallie Castor Jane Show's good friend Amy Siskin, who was our guest on March 14th. And for further information on that very powerful event day, you can go to thenewagenda.org. Castor Jane Show Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern and Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Blog Talk Radio Network. By the way, we will be making a huge announcement about an upcoming show at the end of next week's show. So you'll want to listen in just to hear that. We are very excited. What do you hear? Who we are going to have on our show. Stay in touch, won't you? You can visit me at HallieCasterJane.com, on Facebook at HallieCasterJane, and on Twitter at HallieCJ. I really do love to hear from all of you. Also, our radio player is available to you from